I'm Matthias Valina, speaking with Lynn Emanuel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, November 22nd, 2002. Do you see any connection between Calvino and the metafiction approach and noir writing?
Actually, yeah, now that you mention it, I think that's a great observation. And yeah, I think there really is. I think that one of the givens of noir writing is its irony, its self-consciousness, its incredibly stylized surface and way of being. The plots, I can't remember, because I have to say now it's been a long time since I've read Raymond Chandler, but there are a number of his novels where you have really, you cannot know what's going on, and it doesn't matter what's going on. Mm-hmm. What's important is the style of it and the language of it and the cultural critique of it and all of that. So yeah, I think there is a connection there, although I hadn't made it until you asked me that question.
I guess I'm interested in how influence works. For me, so much of the dominant model for that was anxiety of influence. You know, and that's how I was taught you are to understand all influence. And the more I think about it, the less that model makes sense in the actions of taking in the whole world, taking in the world of poetry and writing and coming up with some new product. And while I could see Calvino's influence on you fitting into that model, Stein seems to be so much more of a foundational or a thinking influence. I guess I was interested in influences that don't fit Bloom's model.
So you mean even the actual work, Bloom's work, the kind of influence that had on you as a writer, the ideas of that book? I can name, I think, at least three different models of influence that I feel operate on me or in me or with me. And one, I like that word foundational. It is an interesting assumption, isn't it, about writing, that influence will show itself in a certain way. It will manifest itself in this way. It is actually very formulaic to think about things that way. I mean, for instance, in the sciences, it would be much more recognizable that a certain work would have what you're calling a foundational influence, but that whatever work you did may not bear a direct relation to that earlier work, you know, that earlier discovery or whatever it might be. So one would be a kind of foundational influence, and maybe most of my important influences are those. I mean, I studied with Adrienne Rich in 1972-73 when Diving into the Wreck was published. That was a seminal influence, that experience, beyond probably any other. But my writing is nothing like Rich's. And I think that without my asserting the importance of her work, asserting the importance of my studying with her, I'm not sure that you would even know that from my own writing. And yet it is the case. For me, the Gertrude Stein poem, as is actually the last poem, the title poem of The Dig, it's about the way influences choose the writer, rather than the writer choosing the influence. It's about the way that certain kinds of figures or ideas or whatever seem to walk out of the culture and knock on your door, and they're inconvenient. I mean, I've got one poem to Gertrude Stein. I found that a very inconvenient fact. I knew it would raise questions about, well, what is this poem doing in here, especially mm-hmm. since nothing else looks like it. You know, I mean, it is very inconvenient. I think other inconvenient influences would probably be, given at the time that I was writing and when I was a young writer, Plath and Sexton, those kinds of writers. I think sometimes you don't get to choose your influences. They choose you. They're using you to leave the grave. And you don't necessarily get to say, oh yes, well, you are my beloved. It doesn't quite work like that. And I don't think that's the same as anxiety. I see it as a struggle, but I don't see it in the Bloomian sense as that anxiety. I see it as an inhabitation, a complicated, symbiotic relationship, but not one that you don't need to lop off the phallus. It's something different than that. I think one, that it doesn't need to show up stylistically. I think mm-hmm. two, influence is a kind of at least a dialogue. The influential writer says something to you, you say something back to that writer. She presses against you, you press against her. She rewrites you, you rewrite her. That's, I think, how I see it.
Was that the goal of the Whitman poem and the Stein poem?
Yes, it was. The Whitman poem was really much more than an homage to Whitman. It was really an homage to Fernando Pessoa, who in the late 20s, I guess, wrote this exceptional poem about Whitman, the most stunning sort of both love poem and critique of a contemporary writer that I know of. And in this critique, he really sees Whitman in the most contemporary ways. I mean, he is the one who calls Whitman the poet of stampeding ambition. And he is the one who diagnoses Whitman's politics as something other than simply the way we think of him, the great liberal, the great Democrat. He's the one who really critiques Whitman as that American who feels he has the right to inhabit any experience, to appropriate any suffering, who feels that he is able to know how the horse feels in the harness and the worker feels in the field. It's an astonishing poem. This was the anxiety of influence. At least I can write about Whitman in a cheekier way, have a kind of cheekier critique of him.
Did you stop reading Calvino?
Yes, I have stopped.
Has that...
It's like stopping smoking.
Has stopping effect?
I still have not read The Baron and the Trees, which a lot of people think is his best novel. I think it was one of his very earliest. No, I have not read that.
You'd said before about being in Iowa, having the time to start thinking about a book rather than sneaking poems around your life. And your books, to me, seem to be such concentrated pieces to themselves. All the poems seem to speak to each other. The books seem to take on unified intellectual challenges. Then suddenly seems to explore every permutation of dialogue between reader and poet and speaker and poet and influence. So I'm wondering if you have a kind of unified idea when you're working on these books.
No, I don't.
No.
Then suddenly started out as a book I wanted to write about film. I wanted to write about the differences between film and poetry. I adore film. That didn't work out. I noticed that you had a question about issues of moving. That's sort of where that idea came from, you know, the moving pictures and how moving film is, how much more moving, in a sense, it is, can be than, say, poems. But I often start out with a kind of dichotomy, you know, or a kind of binary. Film, poetry, moving, stillness. And then I work from there. But, you know, I think that being overworked, it's like writing a novel is compared to writing short stories. I think sometimes it's easier to have an extended piece that you're working on rather than every time you sit down at the page saying, okay, I'm starting a new poem. What is it about? But to see that, oh, I have this context and I have these pressures that are moving this way and that way in these different poems, and maybe I will speak to those in a different way, or I've been reading X and that's an interesting way to think about these other things that I've been thinking about. I think when you're exceptionally overworked, that can be a better way or an easier way to write than sitting down and saying, it's Tuesday, I will write a poem.
Once that context becomes clear, do you find yourself writing the sneaky poems that don't fit into it then?
I certainly did that with The Dig. At a certain point, this story of this little town in Nevada and all of that, and I was going to throw up if I had to write any more of those poems. I can't remember where I got the idea, but the idea came to me. If the narrator were to die, I would have a whole other landscape to work with. And then, I mean, this is a kind of spooky parallel. As I was writing Then Suddenly, my father did die. I was simply not able to get around that in any way. So that kind of broke open the book.
It's also, for me at least, the part of the book that forces the reader to reevaluate the seriousness of what is going on, that no longer are these literary techniques and esoteric ideas being explored, but a real, honest-to-God dramatic situation has inserted itself. I was wondering whether you had qualms fitting the autobiographical material into a book that was very much about ideas and techniques.
Well, first of all, thank you for that reading. that would be my ideal reading of the book and the function of that autobiographical material in Then Suddenly. I don't know if I had qualms. I didn't feel I had a choice. My great grief at that time, aside from, you know, the classical grief of grieving for someone who's gone, is the lack of a tradition for writing the great elegy. I wanted to be Keats. And I felt the sorrow of the historical moment so deeply. Those grand elegies. I wanted to be Tennyson. I wanted to write In Memoriam. I wanted to have all of that possibility. And I didn't. So I don't think I felt uncomfortable. I saw these poems as the best or the only possible elegies of the time. That's how I explained them. I think that one of the really tough things about Then Suddenly, and what's made it very hard to work, I was then, what, I was like 49 before I experienced real mortality. And I was totally, you know, in a sense, unprepared for it. What happened was it absolutely evaporated both my love of and my confidence in language. And so most of the poems to and about my father, for my father, with my father as a collaborator, I hardly recognize their style. There are too many words in the lines. I don't recognize the line lengths. I don't recognize the line breaks. I don't recognize the images. To me, they feel utterly odd. And I think it was because I no longer had any confidence in language or poetry to please or comfort or anything. And it's actually taken me a long time to recover from that. It's taken a long time to get back a sense of the pleasure and take pleasure in the sort of materiality of language and poem and sound.
How has that pleasure for you changed now?
Well, I try not to think too much about my lapse of faith. My new poems are longer. They are much more fluidly lineated. The lines come, they go. There are thick stanzas followed by rivery couplets, long, thin lines followed by short, stocky chunks of language. I can't write the poem that needs to be in the column anymore. I don't know why, but that vase is broken for me. And whatever I'm feeling, it's not going to go into that particular vessel. And oddly, I think that one of the things that's happened is my language is, I'm hoping, I think this is happening, it's even getting richer, a little more voluptuous, as a way of pressing back against the sense that language, at the end, the body wins. I think that my language has gotten thicker, more delicious, as a way to sort of press back against that period when I couldn't do it. I had no courage to take up a word.
You mentioned not writing in the column now. To me, I think that you've strayed away from that pretty frequently in the past as well. When you've worked with longer lines in the past, has it been to achieve a particular effect, a more prose-like effect, which I see sometimes in your poems with longer lines? I guess I'm asking how you use the longer lines and the not-so-columned approach in the past.
I can talk about that in Then Suddenly as an example. Molly Peacock said, and I think she said something like, I was so unhappy and so hurt that the only way I could write a poem was to move from syllable to syllable. And then she says some wonderful thing like, and so that's how I started counting syllables and that's how I became a formalist, which I think is a kind of wonderful explanation and so much more satisfying than I loved Wordsworth. I think the prosier lines, especially in Then Suddenly, came out of just what I was describing. I was not capable of writing what to me was a more shapely line. I just couldn't do it. And so that's how it happened. I did not do it for an aesthetic effect. I did it because I was incapable of a certain tautness of language that had informed my first two books. I was incapable of it. So that's where it came from.
So you maybe lost a belief in the shapeliness as well?
I think for me it took a lot of control and energy and stamina to write a shorter line and a more shaped, thin poem. When I was grieving, I did not have the stamina or the control or the resources to do that. Ashbery says that it's really taking out things that makes the poem. I didn't know what to take out. And so the line grew long and it got prosier, and that's how it happened.
Go back up to that idea of moving.
Okay.
You mentioned before. Einstein's quote in the book of nothing happens until something moves.
Right.
What is this idea of moving? How do you define it fully, I guess?
It was my meditation on what is it the poetry can do? What kind of animal is it? I think, and I don't think I'm alone in this, although I think I share this sense with people who don't necessarily write like me, but I think there's a sense of what is poetry's function? Or not function, but why do we need it? And I felt, as a person walking around in the world, that I could sit down and read a book of poems, and then I could go to a film, a movie, and the classical way that I was used to feeling moved happened much more readily in the film than in the book of poems. And so partly, I just kind of obsessively moved that word around in the book as I pondered this, that catharsis and all of that job that literature seemed to do was now being done by this other kind of text, you know, the filmic text. And that also in another way, it's about the artifact of the book, about the dryness of that, that the low technology of turning the page to continue something. Stein says people sitting in movies are not, they're not looking, they're dreaming. In film, you simply sit there and the dream passes before you. It's liquid and complex and, you know, and all of that. And you're much more, I think, of a voyeur in a sense, but nevertheless. So I think that's the connection that I made. And then I think Stein is right. I mean, I think there's something about American culture getting in the car and going. I mean, my childhood was spent on planes and trains. And I don't think I was alone in this. I mean, I think a lot of American children, you know, they grow up one place, they move here, they go there, they end up here, they, you know, like, where are you from? I mean, some people are from a single place, but a lot of Americans have lived 3, 4, 5 places. And it's always a process of going someplace, moving someplace, leaving something, going someplace else.
Just to close up, I guess, what are you working on right now?
I counted it up, and it was like 7 years between my first and second book and 7 years between my second and third book. And I'm 5 years into that period, and that 5 years, I have had a job. I'm administrating a writing program that is the size of the college I went to. I mean, I have done this job gladly and with great interest and excitement, but I have to say that the energy that it has taken, it's going to be a while before I have another book. What I'm working on right now is, I think I described to you how I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the form of it. What I know is I want the language to do X, and I want the lines to do this other kind of thing. And I want the poems to feel that they can go on and unroll and unroll and unroll. And that I don't have to think anymore about the column, and I don't even have to think about snipping things off at the end. I'm writing what I think is going to be a long poem, and all the sections are just connected by ampersands, so that where in long poems you'll sometimes get a little symbol or an asterisk. And I think that the poem is about plenty. And it's again another argument with the culture of plenty, which is the American culture, and the bard of the plentiful, who is Whitman. Mm-hmm. It is about, after having not had plentiful writing, having it again, and the conflicts of that, the sense of colonization with the voice, that every blank thing, every computer screen, every page, every surface is inscribed with your voice and your words, and the overflow of that. So it's about that. It's about that expansiveness. It's about goods and services. It's about the too muchness, mm-hmm. as both a blessing, as I think the too muchness of Whitman is an enormous blessing, and also the sort of politics of too muchness. But the opposite of too muchness is dearth, and you don't want that either. So all I know is that there are these ampersands, and that I am in the poem mistress of the ampersand, guilty. Guilty of the ampersand that adds and adds and adds and adds. Guilty of the and. Guilty of also. Guilty of furthermore. That is the character I play in the new poems. The character who is guilty of plentifulness. And, you know, living in a culture of plenty.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.